This is the Hear Hear podcast. Today we are joined by Brian Chrisman, owner and operator of Chrisman's Wyndham House, and Eric Gutcha, former owner-operator of the Thompson House, also located in Wyndham, New York, to discuss the contrast between short-term rental properties and resort business ownership in a tourist town. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for Jesse. Coming on. So whoever would like to take the reins first, I would just like to ask kind of a short history. You guys are both involved in legacy family resorts. So kind of a highlight reel, like when the family took over, how did the operations were managed under your ownership, and then maybe a little bit about how the town has changed in those years. I know when we talked to Kate, it was the 1950s. When your family took over.
Yeah, well, Eric, you know, they own the Thompson House since...
It goes back to the 1880s, yeah.
So they got it on us, yeah, history-wise.
Yep.
Yeah, we didn't start till the 50s. So Eric, you should probably start.
Yeah, so anyway, it was my great-great-grandparents moved off from North Settlement over to next to the Osborne House, purchased that resort over there and ran it. As a summer place, and people would come up from the city up on the Dayliner and get a buggy ride over to Wyndham. You know, dusty road, probably take them all day. And they still did it. They'd come with their trunks, and they would stay for a couple months because the air was so much cooler. And it just developed into more of a resort with the roads got better, transportation got better, and then Wyndham became a little more accessible. And
that was through Catskill.
That was
right?
through Catskill, yes.
Yeah, so somewhere down so there, yeah. Ferry ride up mm-hmm. from the city the to city. Catskill.
Yep. And so it became our resort became more of a family resort. Back in the 30s, our grandfather built a dam, and the Osborne House and the Thompson House guests used a dam behind the resort as a swimming hole. And then in the early 60s, our cousin was a welder, and they were putting steel pools in for us. And so we had a steel pool put in. That was quite an attraction. And so through the years, it just, you know, the upgrades came along, and it became more attractable for kids and families. And it that's how I grew up. And it was a fun place to grow up. Got new friends every week. It was great through the summertime. So I did a lot of playing in the creek. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. It's a great place to grow up.
Classic mountaintop summer, sounds like
absolutely.
To me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Spent a lot of time in the creek.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah people entertained all these places. There were, of course, many, many resorts in Greene County in the day. I mean, this county was just packed
sure.
with people. Every little cabin had people in it. Some of the bigger resorts like the Thompson House, you had hundreds of people, and they had entertainment, and it was really nice. My parents bought this the Wyndham House in 1952. It was a farm. It was a drover's tavern that was equipped to handle people bringing goods and the livestock to the port in Catskill over these turnpike roads back in the early 1800s. Late 1700s, and that was the origination of the building and the business. So my parents took it over as a dairy farm and big hotel in 52, and the same thing, playing with kids in the summertime. It was a great place to grow up. People loved the farm, and then eventually it morphed into golf. The farm wasn't practical, you know, as far as income. A small dairy farm just didn't cut it. So the farm went over to golf, and that was the beginning of the golf business. So the resort continued on in that vein till today. So, but the county, the amount of resorts in the county, of course, has declined quite a bit over that period of time. And now, as you speak about Airbnbs, there's been somewhat of a resurgence in the amount of lodging available to people to come to the, and also other factors have happened that have driven people up to the mountains from the city. So there is more migration into the area, definitely now.
What were some things that changed in the town since?
Used to roll up carpet up. Yeah, yep. Labor Day, man, you rolled up the carpet, red carpet off of Main Street, and this whole thing shut down.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, the road out of here was rough.
Yes.
You know, you had to know what you're doing to get up here. And it was a small town, you know, that used to go to the school, basketball, Eric, and, yep. and I played sports in the school, and it was just, that was it.
That was it.
And
that
the
was
place
it.
Was alive.
Well, Route 23 you know, was a tough road to navigate back in the day before they put in the road that's out there now. It wound backward. It'd take probably about an hour to get to Catskill.
Yeah, it was a
And it was a turny road, but it was yeah. it was good, but everything was quiet. You know, you say Labor Day, it eventually extended into Columbus Day weekend, but usually it's Labor Day, just things started shutting down. Yeah. You know,
just shut once the summer was over, that was that.
Kids were going back to school, and it was starting to get darker out and colder.
I drive to Caro almost every day, and one of my favorite things is just seeing sections of old 23 wind out and then on to 23 now and then wind back, and it would be a slow, windy ride, for sure.
The road was in rough shape then, too, but well, yeah, the winters were different for sure in a small town. But, you know, then 60, 61, the ski slope came in, you know, and that of course, was the beginning of where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, we were very fortunate to have that happen in Windham. And the result of it is what we have today, which is a huge amount of building. And it's happened ever since 1960. Mm-hmm. There have been ebbs and flows, but there's been a constant increase in buildings and in land value.
Yeah, it changed that summer only resort to more of a year round opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How soon did you guys tap into that?
Well, we did it
personally. We skied our butts off.
Yeah, we did. I remember there was two trails up at Windham. You drove up to where CD Lane Road stops, and that's where the hut was. And they had a T-bar that would go up there, and I'd ride up there between my father's legs. He didn't know how to ski either. We just learned.
Yeah, didn't know how to ski.
And
we never
go between his legs and get to the top, and you went down the novice trail or down the expert trail. Yeah, one or the other.
Yeah. You had two options.
Or through the woods. Through the woods was great.
That was the early days, boy. We didn't know nothing.
Yeah.
And all we wanted to know is we were going to do it for sure. All
of
us. All of our families. So it was great times. We just had a ball on the old T-bar. It was a rough old beginning, but it made it, for sure.
Yep. It did. And you could see the expansion. The expansion was great. It always made for better skiing, and through the years it changed a little bit. You know, I don't want to get political, but I remember that it went private, and if you want, I don't think I want to talk about that. But you know, that's why I ended up leaving Windham and skiing somewhere else with your sister. We used to drive up to Glens Falls four times a week.
I know. Yeah. We were just up there the other night.
Okay.
We drove up. Natalie lives up there.
Okay.
And man, you can't even look at that.
Was that West?
West Mountain.
Yeah, sure.
I drove up there. Yeah. I made it in 91 minutes one time.
Mike and Nat. Yeah. He was the coach.
Yeah. So sorry to get off track. But
that's good stuff.
But that's why. That's why the mountain went through so many changes, and that's why I think that's where we're at today, because it went private and there was no money going into having good skiing. And then all of a sudden the 80s came along, the mountain was sold to Ski Round Top, I believe is the name of the company, and all of a sudden you saw snowmaking just coming out all over and improvement in the conditions of the skiing, you know, lifts and things like that. And so that attracted a lot more of the public to come up, and that's kind of how we got into the winter phase of it. It was in 1983. My brother and I were running the business, Doug. And we saw that there was a lot of cars going by. And it's like, you know what? We could use more capacity in the summertime. Why not build a building that we could use year round?
Right.
And we got the plans out. And before you know it, we were putting up another 15 a unit motel on the side over by the golf course.
You built a building specifically for it because prior to that it was summer only, which you can't have open during the wintertime.
Correct. And those buildings weren't really built for wintertime.
Yeah.
You shut those down, you drain all the water out, and the electricity gets shut right off. And then And so we needed a building that would go through the seasons. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, environmentally, structurally, and, you know, it was a good building. So it was great.
We did the similar thing. We built a building that was more or less specific, you know, built for this increased ski season business. Mm-hmm. We opened up probably in the mid-70s to take people from the mountain. Yep. There was nothing in the winter. There was no lodging in the town. It was pretty well shut down. A lot of the resorts were closed. And like Eric said, you know, you just went away in the wintertime. And then there was a demand that came for rooms, and that's, they responded, and we did the same thing. Other places built other places too.
Mm-hmm. Go back in the '80s and the '90s when you'd see cars parked all the way down South Street, all the way to 296, not to 296, but to the pretty much to the golf course on both sides of the road. I mean, there's a lot of people up here.
Yeah,
and that it was definitely
so it was noticeable and worth tapping into.
Absolutely,
at that point in time. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
you know, that's how we got into the winter business. Yeah, yeah, and you do a little more seasonal, right?
Yeah, it's morphed some, mm-hmm. you know, when the changed policies, and it's been up and down, there's been changes that have happened on the mountain that have caused some issues with people coming and going, changing the pricing, and so there have been some issues with public relations with the mountain and people not being sure what the mountain is, mm-hmm. even though they've invested a tremendous amount in their snowmaking, they've done a great job. We've had some really poor winters.
Yeah,
this one being another one. This is three in a row.
Yeah,
so they've been able to keep their programs going. Unlike in the '70s when they didn't put the money in the snowmaking, this time around, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of money put into the snowmaking. They have a lot of state of the art equipment. So, you know, we're fortunate in that way that they're able to keep operating, even though we've had some pretty poor conditions. Yeah. So
there was another good one that came up with Kate to throw it back further again, back into the 70s and 80s, when as you saw the increase in winter tourism, was there a decline in the summer tourism, possibly due to indoor air conditioning, is the one that came up, was that people stopped coming up to the mountaintop to escape the heat of the city because they didn't need to anymore?
That might be a little bit because they did. I mean, it was definitely cooled up here. I mean, we didn't have air conditioning in our house. The nights were always cooler. But I would attribute some of that maybe to ease of travel, airfare, because you could jump on a plane and be in Mexico in a few hours for just a couple $100.
Right.
Yeah, destination guaranteed.
Yeah.
When you look at Disney World, when they open Disney World and People's Express Airlines with cheap air flights, and the Disney vacation was a guaranteed winner.
Yep.
And, you know, people were looking at that, and that became a thing that definitely impacted our businesses.
Yeah.
You know, families would save that money. Demographics were a huge change. Your family used to have one, their father worked at a job, a union job, had enough income to come to the country here and stay for 2 weeks with their family. That kind of went away. Both parents are working now, and trying to coordinate the vacation times, it became an issue too. So there are several factors that were involved in that stressing our businesses.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, definitely, I didn't know about the whole other building being built specifically for ski season.
Mm-hmm.
So that's incredible. Did you do that to any other buildings to keep more open during the ski season as well time?
Well, there were attached to that 15-unit building that we built in 84, we had a 10-unit motel that we put out by the golf course, because golf back in the 60s was huge, maybe 50s and 60s, 70s was huge. And so in 64, they built a 10-unit motel overlooking the golf course, beautiful view, and the golfers that would come up during the summer for 2 weeks at a time loved it. They, you know, looked right out on the ninth hole.
Right.
And it was fantastic. So to get back to your question, we had the 15-unit there. And then over, had to be like 10 years. We operated just the 15 rooms that had the other part shut down. And we're saying, you know, this isn't really winterized. So slowly, 1 year, we gutted four rooms in that 10 unit. And we brought the insulation up to par. We put in better heating systems. And those were sold out. And it's like, okay, this is a no-brainer. We did the other six the next year. Yep. And so then we had a 25-unit motel. And it definitely sustained itself. And it was definitely the right move. Yeah.
Yeah, we've done this similar,
you know, yeah.
Winterizing older buildings. And we actually took the old inn and winterized it and made a restaurant out of it and guest rooms out of it, you know, which, like Eric said, you would just normally shut it down, drain it. And
What a process even to bring it up to standard for a winter up here for those old buildings is like... Yeah. That's a process all by itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is,
you know.
But economically, it made it worthwhile with all the public that was coming through here. I mean, right. Wyndham was booming, probably like 7,000 skiers. I shouldn't even say the numbers. I don't know, but you know, I'm thinking at least 7,000-8,000 skiers coming through here a day. You know, and so everybody was doing well.
Yep. So a good one would be the daily operations at a resort. Like that size. And I know this is going to give some people, you know, maybe a little a flashback for Eric, you know, to the wilder days. But kind of a, however you want to frame it, you know, I would love to hear about the daily requirements of running a resort that size, especially busy season when you have, you know, full guests and out to, you know, the seasonal shifts. You know, you have full buildings to close down. You know, the ones that aren't winterized, that you're going through all of that process. That process alone is a large chunk of time. Just to kind of give people, I guess, an understanding of how much time you spend working with your guests and making sure all of your operations are in order, and then how that shifts from season to season and over the course of the year.
Well, you've got, in my case, we have 50 rooms that are available, plus a couple other apartments and other places. So that's a, you know, if you think about your own house, maintaining that, you know, you just add a few, 10 times to that.
Yeah.
And that's a daily thing. Requirements of the health department, you know, are always something we're, you know, cognizant of and keeping track of. Cleanliness, and we, in our case, we run a kitchen in the for breakfast in the wintertime. Summer's a whole other thing, but we do have it open for breakfast in the summertime. And heating rooms, making sure everything's working right, cleaning and keeping staff going. For us, the golf business, of course, that's a whole nother side of it. And we have guys working all winter on equipment and not working in the shop. So we have a lot going on in the wintertime.
Just as far as like maintenance.
Yeah.
Yeah. To keep exactly. The summer stuff going.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. There's a lot to it for sure.
Yeah. And even to the health department stuff. I mean, what's the requirements out of that? Are you regularly scheduled for?
To test water every day in about four buildings.
Yep.
And be responsible for keeping the chlorination levels where they should be. That's, you know, fire systems, you know, safety, you know, requirements for safety and insurance companies. Those are some of the backbone things that are daily responsibilities.
Daily, yeah.
So, I mean, that's time those are the time consuming.
Massive, yeah.
Yep.
Massive time sink.
You always have to check exit lights, make sure all the bulbs are working, make sure you have fire doors in all the different corridors that you have to make sure they're always working correctly, that nobody's propped them open. They always have to close within a certain degree at a certain amount of time. But just basically they would come through and just check everything. You know, railings, all your, you know, your exits, you know, all your steps.
How often were those inspections?
It was usually unannounced and normally just once a summer.
Okay.
But there was different inspectors that would come through. There'd be the fire and safety guy, and then there'd be the pool guy, Joe Capobianco, great guy. He always came in, did his test, knew what he was doing. And then a gentleman would always come and do the kitchen.
Yeah, you had three different guys.
And, but they would check everything, everything from your slicers to your cooler temperatures.
And for a while, we had two kitchen checks a year. I mean, it's changed depending on what their staff is in Oneonta. Mm-hmm. They're random checks, and they come through a couple times a year and check things out. And like Eric said, you got different people, but mm-hmm. it keeps you thinking about it.
All the time. You do, and you have to record everything. When you do different stuff, especially like we had a pool, so you had to check the chlorine, the pH three times a day,
and that's documented.
It's all documented, yes. Yep. And that was the first thing that the inspector would come. He'd come and sign off on your sheet, make sure it was up to date. And everything.
Mm-hmm. How much of that did you make Evan do? Did Evan ever have to do any? Did you give him a clipboard and make him run around through all the buildings?
I think he liked to maybe sweep the pool once in a while. But I think once he did the ring around the pool, I think he was done.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So a pretty nonstop workload.
It pretty much was, and depending on who you had in charge and what was going on that day. But yeah, you think about, you have 70 toilets to maintain. Hopefully they're working correctly, and hopefully the water is running through the pipes correctly, and you don't have any breaks in your lines. Hopefully your septic's not backing up.
The conversation we had before we came on the mics about burst pipes, and correct. Brian immediately goes into dealing with burst pipes. Right. It's like 50 rooms. If you think about maintaining one house, is 50 chances for that. So,
and that was always an issue when you shut down your building. Is that you hope that all your pipes are going to drain, and through the years, you turn the water on and you have people standing by telling you to shut that water off.
Doesn't sound good.
Somebody's tapping on the pipe. It's like that time to shut it off, and you got to go find it and then put it all back together.
And TVs, electronics in the rooms, those stuff, refrigerators, TVs, people can't manage, TVs. So you get to be pretty good at keeping the electronics going. Internet service, that's a whole nother, in a big property, that's an issue, getting Wi-Fi to everybody.
Oh, sure.
There's definitely a demand in these days.
Yeah, for sure.
So, it's all these little things that are daily things that you're dealing with. You may not deal with it for sometimes, but then other times it becomes a total focus.
Yeah.
We just replaced a wire to a Wi-Fi router in one of our buildings yesterday. We had to actually replace a whole wire outside, but we didn't know why, but it wasn't working. And if people are standing there looking at you like, we want our email.
I want my internet.
That's right.
That's right. And Brian, what year is the big house at Chrisman's?
Built probably early 1800. We say 1805. It was definitely built along in that vein somewhere.
Sure. And what were the houses at Thompson House?
I think it was more like around the 1840s.
Yeah. So a lot of that stuff, the indoor plumbing and stuff there.
Oh, there was none.
There was none at the time of construction.
No.
They had outhouses. I know when I was growing up, there was
we had outhouses.
Outhouses in the back. Yeah.
Plumbing was probably put in 1920 maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the first
Everything would have been wash basin pipe. That stuff
they had wash basins in the rooms probably. I don't know when it was, probably 1920s somewhere.
It was all galvanized,
early 1900s,
all galvanized
Well, to the point is that you're talking about buildings that were never fit for any of this.
No. Exactly.
You have the first iteration in the 1920s, and then the continued adapting over the years.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It was my understanding that my great-grandfather developed some type of gas mechanism because we go into the old walls and find some gas iron pipe in the walls, and I guess he had something going on in the cellar that would generate a certain type of gas, and he could light up all the hallways and in the rooms.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So he had light fixtures.
Gas fixtures.
Wow.
Yeah, the old cars had acetylene gas for light headlights. So, who knows?
Many different lifetimes in that building, in those buildings of adapting to change as the whatever whatever new technology or what's happening in town. Cooling
systems. They used to have ice houses down in the cellar, you know. Then they built, you know, ice boxes with the big heavy wood doors. And then it went to refrigeration.
Yep.
And the cellars were used to keep the vegetables cool. And there's in one part of the building, there was a big coal shaft, you know, where coal came down to feed the furnaces.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the ice pond. We have a ice pond mm-hmm. on the property, which they use for that, cutting off ice. We had the tools, the saws mm-hmm. and different.
Where is that? Which one?
It's at by that house. Christmas,
whatever. Yeah,
we have it. It doesn't look like it's kind of silted in. It's still there though.
Yeah.
But that was the ice pond they used in the day, and we had the equipment, the saws and the skates and stuff they use. But yeah, that was part of it. Was mm-hmm. sawdust and holding ice and sawdust over the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a major part of the deal. Yeah.
Sure.
And you go out to that museum out there and. What's the name of that museum out there?
Meredith.
Meredith, exactly. East Meredith. They have a really nice colonial museum down there, and they do ice harvesting. They actually come out with horses and cut the blocks, and it's fun. It's in late February, I think, they do that. Yeah. That's a fun thing to go to.
That's awesome.
If anybody ever wanted to see it.
Yeah.
Nobody realizes. You just don't open up the refrigerator door.
Right. Especially for a resort like that or a space like that.
Yeah.
So moving into kind of the current environment up here, as you guys went from the drive-by traffic or the growth of the resort that gave you year round. How did it transition? How was the transition? Or I guess I would let you speak to it of more of an online presence where you're having online bookings, you're going to an online system. Do you have an idea of about what year that would have been that you would have started doing online bookings versus over the phone or the repeats. Yeah. I know Scott Tuttle loves to talk about the families that came up to Chrisman's every year from when he was a kid, and he would see him every summer.
Yeah.
You know, so it's quite a shift, right? From that type of lifestyle, you know, business format to now this digital where anybody from anywhere in the world can do it.
Around 2000, 2005.
Was it that early?
When was the
early?
Gateway? When did the Gateway come out with their computers? I started right off the bat.
We didn't do a lot of online booking until I think Kurt was in. You know, we were very fortunate to have our son Kurt come into the business. He had just graduated from a business school up in Oswego, and he was very tech savvy, and we let him take advantage of that because I am not that tech savvy. And he did a lot more of the online booking, grabbing that. I don't think that we did a lot until probably more around 2012. It probably became more prominent that we had to do, you know, he's doing a lot of email before that. Mm-hmm. But as far as getting into booking.com.
Yeah, 10 years maybe. 10 years.
I think is where it was. And then it became quite a bit more. But we, a lot of our business was... done on a weekly basis because we had a dining room and we had entertainment. And so we didn't go out and pursue the online booking quite as much as other people did.
Yeah, it was more of a winter. The online booking thing was more of a winter weekend transient because most people were coming just for the weekend.
Sure.
The resort business in summertime was more of a week-long type of stay. So that wasn't so much... online, you know, you're promoting yourself with a website, but the actual booking that was coming a little later, you know, maybe 10 years ago, it became really
so
strong.
2012.
Yeah. I think about 10 years ago when it started to become a big deal where the county promotion people were really pushing, you know, you need to do this, you know, you need to have online. And we, you know, the bigger places all had, you know, went to it right away.
Sure.
We're trying to push the littler guys to get with it.
Yeah.
But
was there a noticeable difference?
It just made it more convenient. We used to take a tremendous amount of phone calls. I mean, we took phone calls
all night.
All day. Yeah. It was a tremendous amount of phone calling because people would call multiple places.
Sure.
So you'd just be all day. With the online booking, it cut some of that out. People can go online and see if there's a room available. They don't have to call you and say, is there a room available? I mean, it just took some of the communication out of making
it
easier.
Yeah, a little bit of that legwork.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it didn't take it all. I mean, people still want to talk to somebody. They want a person on the other end. They want to talk to the owner. And most people like to book their reservation by talking to people. Still, you get that. But it did make things easier.
Yeah. Was there a volume difference as far as
over the years? Definitely. Probably, if you're talking about our winter bookings, it probably went from in the start maybe 5% of the business to when we were just getting out of it, probably more like around over 50% of it, maybe even more. You might even see a lot
more. We weren't quite that high, but it's a similar rise. The winter business took to the point where it was very busy in winter time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Until maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe about 10 years ago, it got to be where it started a little bit of a lessening, you know, where you just didn't get the same pressure that we had before.
Mm.
So it started about 10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's starting to ease up.
You talking about as far as bookings go?
Yeah.
Number of bookings, yes. Yep. Yeah.
Like overall quantity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, winter particularly. Yeah.
And that kind of fell into where we were losing bookings actually to, I think, the market of you're getting into for Airbnb. And that was one of my gripes to our governor, not to our governor, but our senator and our assemblyman. And so I actually wrote letters to these guys. Saying, you know, I understand there's a market for that, and I can understand the families want to be together, but it's like we're not playing on the same field because we have to abide by all your regulations. We have to keep records of everything, paying our sales tax on a weekly basis, and you know,
a weekly.
I think I had to keep track of
it. You keep track of it weekly, okay.
And then it had to get sent in.
Yeah, was it still quarterly, or did you have to do monthly? Because you
got reconciliated, I believe, in the quarter.
Yeah, okay, okay.
But at the same time, you know, we're dealing with the health department coming through. We have to make sure that our water quality is good. This is before we had town water, and so I'm saying, how come these other guys don't have to get regulated? And one part that really opened my eyes is that I'm a local fireman. We went to a fire down the road here, and it was an Airbnb, and the kitchen had burned right up, and the renters were outside at the fire pit. And they said, why didn't you use a fire extinguisher? Oh, couldn't find one. And so right then it just says, you know, how come these guys aren't going through the same process that we are as far as fire and safety, water quality, and things like that. And I thought that should be opened up, you know, to make sure that, you know, we're on the same, we're dealing with the same issues.
Yeah.
You know, because that takes time from us. It takes money. Making sure, like I said, all of your exit signs are lit. All your exits and stairways are shoveled all the time. You know, and never heard back from them, but
I'm so surprised. I'm so surprised.
More of them than us.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we're in the same boat. You know, we have to maintain standards that the Airbnbs don't have to maintain at all.
Yeah.
You know, just open the door and book it. So,
well, I'll read you guys a couple of things just to kind of speak to that point, it's just going to solidify what you've already said, but. Just a few statistics on Airbnb was founded in 2008, and then it won an award in 2011. So we're talking right within that time frame. I mean, a very recent past. Mm-hmm. And to your point of reaching out to the governing body is they always seem to lag behind, especially on technology stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what we're living through right in this moment is, I wouldn't necessarily call it like government oversight, but it's a lack of understanding of the repercussions of a technology like that being in place. So right along to your timeline is Founded in 2008, 2011, wins an award. There was one other stat that I didn't put in here, but it was something like 2013. They had 9 million reservations at that point. So just a very rapid expansion, you know, to all markets. Right now, if you open the app, which Evan and I both did this on our apps for Airbnb, if you just type in Wyndham, New York, you want to guess how many?
Hundreds.
Yep. I'd say probably like 600.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if, depending on what you set it to, okay, so it doesn't give you a Wyndham only. There's not a town line.
Okay.
It gives you the Wyndham region. But when you first type it in, there are over 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if you zoom it in to get Hunter out and the Durham Valley, you're still over 900.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wyndham proper. If you were to say within the WAJ district, mm-hmm. you're probably in the range of 800 to 900.
But then to getting back to my point, also is that, you know, we have to charge an 8% sales tax on top of our rates. And so when we say our room's $100, it's actually $108, where you could go to an Airbnb, and I don't believe they have to charge at the time. Maybe they do now, but they don't charge sales tax. So the county is not, you know, getting that revenue to help maintain the roads and you know, to help, you know, get grants for water and for septic and things like that.
Yeah.
And maybe that's changed now, but I know back in the day, nobody seemed to care about all that lost revenue, and it's got to be millions.
We'll look that up, and we'll cut that in. I'll look up what the state of New York, if the state of New York mm-hmm. requires sales tax. That's one thing I don't have. But there's one town, there are a couple of local towns that do have regulation on the books, and it's only a couple of them. Wyndham has no regulation. Ashland has no regulation. So in a local town, this is the, other than basic information, you have a water test that needs to be within 3 years. Yeah. CO2 and fire alarms, the proof of residence, and the listing URLs. So that's other than contact information and unit information. That's it. The only other thing that I'll add to this one bit is that the code enforcement will check that it abides by, you know, standard codes of occupancy. But this is verbatim from the town regulation. An inspection of the premises shall be conducted by the code enforcement officer upon initial application. So one time. After a period of 1 year of lawful operation, the code enforcement officer may conduct random inspections to ensure compliance. So that means you have one inspection the first time you register, and then possibly never another inspection.
Yeah.
It's just going to be your CO. The inspection is going to be your CO.
Well, this is specifically for the for Airbnb.
When you register your Airbnb.
So when you register it with the town, the code enforcement officer has to show up one time.
And that's in the town of Wyndham?
This is Jewett.
Jewett, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because there are only a couple towns up here that have any regulation on the books. That's why I want to cut back in if there is anything from the state as far as collecting
sales tax.
Mm-hmm. Because as far as I know, and I have this point in here as well, just to compare the tax requirements out of an Airbnb versus what you guys deal with, other than the property tax and income tax, I don't know if there's a sales tax, but we'll
and it would be a county. I think the county would have to initiate
county.
That.
Yeah.
But yeah, lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No. So to speak to that point of, you know, you have one, you're required one inspection a year versus.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, it's getting into part of the we're in a business that we have to get insurance also, and we pay a high rate of insurance because of our liabilities. The exposure is so high.
Well, we're actually required. We are licensed. It's not just inspected. We're inspected under the gun of either getting issued a license or not. So every year we're issued a license to operate. It's not just doing the inspections. They have to.
Right, the health department sends out
a certificate. They can say, we don't like you.
Right, and you have to show that you have workman's comp. You have to have all
these different requirements. Yeah, you have to prove the insurances. Yeah, that's a new wrinkle in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Show us proof that you have, you know, workers' comp and liability. Mm-hmm. They have to actually prove both of them.
Yeah.
You know, new wrinkle.
It's absorbent, the amount of insurance that you have to cover.
No, absolutely.
And you know, just to make sure that you're operating properly, but, you know.
Yeah, insurance has gone crazy. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if there's a requirement for the Airbnb dwellings. You know,
right, for any basic insurance,
right,
other than homeowners insurance.
Yeah,
which is
that's not required.
I mean,
right. Yeah. Which isn't even required, right?
Mm-hmm. But you know, yeah, because there is exposure there. I mean, somebody could slip and fall, and when they're on our property, it's always an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not sure if they're covered, and if they are covered with insurance, does the carrier know that it's a commercial residence,
right,
or used for a commercial business,
right? And when you look through the requirements from the township, which are the only ones who are putting regulation on it, I'll go back and check, but I don't believe there was any line item for an insurance policy.
Yeah.
It's all contact information.
Yeah. So that was just my whole point, is that it just didn't seem fair.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, they're charging a lesser rate, or they're making out, you know, that they can charge a more competitive rate than we could, because we have all these extra expenses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the demographic issues of what they're doing to these communities. And it's not personal. It's not the fault of the people that are owning these homes and renting them. But it's it's taking the rental market off the market. So there are, you know, people that are trying to work here and be part of the fabric of the community are, as residents, are putting under tremendous stress to find places to rent. And that's a problem for businesses like ours to try to keep employees going year round. It's it makes the housing market extremely difficult.
Very difficult.
It's a common problem. It's in other places too.
Well,
we're facing it.
Yeah, and I feel like that's why that was one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it, because we're a perfect example of it.
Yeah.
Of that, of my generation not being it. Every social scientist and economist will agree that the foundation of a stable citizen is property ownership. Like, if you own a home that you can go back to, that's the beginning of generational wealth. That's the stable citizen. And a kind of interesting collision of technology and history at the same time to put that stress on the demographic.
Yeah, it kind of changes the tenor of the community.
Absolutely.
You know, you've got residents who aren't here. You've got a growing tax base, but your school population is falling. So it's just an odd, you know, like, where is it going kind of a feeling.
Sure.
There's no stability to it. It's increased values, decreased residents.
Yeah.
You know, it's and then weekends you get, the town is packed, you know, but who's going to service these
people? Where, yes.
You know, it's like, where are they coming from? They get displaced. So people travel quite a ways to work.
They do, yeah. Mm. And that's been part of the buildup, you know, to bringing this topic out, was a lot of our friends, you know, we'll sit down. We love going out in Windham. Mm-hmm. We love what the town has. We love what the mountain has. You know, we love golfing, at Christmas in the summertime. And there's so many cool amenities here, and there are so many cool aspects to the community, but this is the most glaring miss. I don't know how to say it, really. It's like, it's the most glaring thing that if the next generation wants to be here, you know, of the people who've grown up here and, you know, spent their childhood here and stuff, that opportunity's not really there as of right now.
Mm-hmm. It definitely has challenges. Yeah, if you want to, you know, because we live here because it's beautiful, of course. Yeah,
of course.
Four seasons, beautiful mountains, you get to go skiing. But yeah, if it's hard to, you know, the kids are having trouble finding places to live.
Yep.
Yeah.
dealing with it, trying to find, tuck people in here and there, and make efficiencies out of pieces of buildings, and mm-hmm. try to accommodate people any way we can.
Yeah,
that's our reality.
A reality.
Yeah,
there's other restaurant owners, business owners in town that this is a conversation we have every single time we talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is they have to be ready to put their people into a stable place before mm-hmm. they can even have the conversation of hiring them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have to have a landing zone for them.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know, some regulation has to be an answer, I would think.
It just made it very appealing for people to come in, and I don't have a personal gripe with anything, but to come in because they have the extra money and they can buy up these pieces of property and renovate them and then rent them out. When we sold our business, we had no place to go, and so the place next to where we're living now is an Airbnb, and we called them up and said, hey, you know, we're looking for a place to rent for a year, you know, start off for a year. And she goes, oh yeah, We'll work something out. I'm sure we can do something for you. It's going to be $44,000. And it's like, wow, I don't know if I could have do that. And that was giving me a deal.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it's like, boy, I'll have to call you back.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's so easy. Why rent to somebody for a couple thousand dollars a month when you can rent it for a weekend, you know,
and make that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't have any easy answers on that.
No. I don't think there is one. No, I don't think there is one, but
no, it's a...
I think the foundation is, you know, justifying the discussion. And I think mm-hmm. that's what we did, mm-hmm. you know, for business owners, for local people who live here. Where the rubber hits the road of the effect, the long term mm-hmm. effect of it being unregulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't. I think it's here, you know, what we're living with now is here to stay. You know, and I don't know how much deeper, you know, they'll get, or how more expensive things will get, or what it'll do to our businesses. I'm just not sure whether there'll be a limit somewhere along the line where people just isn't as popular, or people don't rent as much, or people get tired of renting, and it slows down. I don't know what it is. But we know now that it's just an open free-for-all. Yeah. And people do have problems. I mean, things happen in some of these houses. A kid died up here in Maple Crest from, you know, asphyxiation in a basement, you know, unregulated. So, I mean, people have to be aware that you can have problems, too, in these places.
Sure.
But for the foreseeable future, I don't see much of a change. It would be, you know, the county has to be, it's going to take the county or the state to intervene, because the Airbnb people are a force.
Yeah.
And not just the homeowners, the corporation will come in immediately on your behalf. If you're an owner or a group of owners, you're going to have the big guns with you. Yeah. Against these little towns.
New York City is going through that right now.
Mm-hmm.
They put in some regulation in, I think, 2021 was when it locked in.
Yeah.
And it's adapted and it's changed, and they're on a second version of it already that just went through a couple of months ago. And I think being aware that a change needs to happen, it's just how it's going to happen, right? And just kind of a little foresight and forethought into it to especially on the regulation side and how it's affecting people locally. You know,
some of the things are making the my daughter owns a house in Lake George, and she can only rent it for a month at a time, or so. You know, there are regulations around the length of rental that she can do, so she can't just do a weekend thing. So there are some things that can be done that aren't that onerous to the owners of the properties to just kind of manage the changeover.
Yeah. That's how that was New York City's initial regulation, was that it had to be 30 days plus. And then they had a couple other stipulations, but that was what they pushed for. I had a conversation today with a friend in Tahoe, California, and they have the exact same. I think we're a little bit different that there's not really a place to, where you're talking about how far people will travel. We don't really have, we could kind of go west, but if you're headed east, man, there's, you're not getting a better deal anywhere else. And the Airbnb market has the Hudson Valley locked pretty down, you know, all the way up to Albany. And, you know, he's talking about it being in Lake George. It's like where, you know, for them, in their area, there, a lot of people are moving out of the Tahoe area into Reno, Carson City, which is an hour drive, which I think is exactly what we're talking about. It's forcing out people who would love to be here all the time, would love to be in town all the time, and just isn't a reality.
Yeah.
So if there's, whether or not that will come back or not, who knows, but yeah.
I don't have an answer for you.
No, me either. Well, so far we came up with no answers, Evan. You got anything? I can't believe you didn't have to fill out some paperwork or check the lights or anything.
I did. I had to do some things. I picked up all the cigarette butts.
A lot of cigarettes.
And pie cones.
Yeah.
But he's right. I did 1 year have to do all the tile around the pool. That was pretty aggravating.
1 year?
Yeah, I stopped doing it after that.
Yeah, okay. All the years and daily labor here, and you had one time you had to do something.
It was a brutal job on an angry day to be in that pool scrubbing that tile. Yeah. And all your friends hanging around.
That's
it was tough.
Tough go.
I had that job too.
No, I helped out. I did the little things. Yep. I worked in the kitchen. A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're all like world class dishwashers.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah. That was the best.
That was the best. Yeah. I do dishes any day.
Yeah.
Favorite job.
Yeah. Brian, we would like to extend a thanks to you for setting us up with this space as well.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Yeah. This has been an awesome opportunity. So
absolutely. Very thankful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful studio.
Yeah. You guys have really done a nice job of setting this up. Yeah. It's nice in here.
If you have any good Wyndham or old
like memorabilia,
anything, we got a nice big shelf to fill up. So,
all right, we should come up with some stuff.
I was gonna say it shouldn't be too hard. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom put a scrapbook together for the town for Wyndham. Information, so I can bring that down. Let you guys look at that.
Awesome,
that'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like New York State is doing something about the short-term rentals, according to this article posted today. A bill was signed into law that the governor, put in that there's going to be regulations starting in March that require owners of short-term rentals to register with the State Department, and there will be a 2-year renewal process for data tracking and sales tax.
Oh, okay.
Starting March.
It only took them a decade. That's not bad.
And we didn't time this to line up with that either, did we?
Nope.
Not at all.
Yeah.
I appreciate your time, guys.
Absolutely.
Brian, again, thank you. And hope to have both of you on again at some point, maybe for more of just good old Wyndham history. One good one that we want to take on is the Battle Royale for 4th of July parades. Uh-huh. We heard that was a...
Chrisman's always has some great floats. They do.
You guys did too.
Yeah,
we had fun with that. We were only people crazy enough to put the kind of time and effort into building that stuff. Yeah. That was always fun.
Yeah. Well, Kate challenged us to it, so we're gonna have a podcast float this year. Nice. I don't know if it'll be on par with, with the classic Chrisman, but
I don't know if we can.
No, I don't think so.
That's a standard.
Yeah, that's the bar.
That's a little craziness there, for sure.
Yeah, but thanks again for coming in. Yep. This was a great discussion.
No, thanks guys. Appreciate it. I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah,
that's great.
Great.
This is the Hear Hear podcast, hosted by Jesse Novak, produced by Evan Gutcha. Thank you very much for listening.